we really did set the model for this kind of library in the United States. Until that is, you get to the year 1807. Because it was in 1807 that the Boston Athenaeum was created. And it had an entirely different model. The founders, 19 men, mostly actually in their 20s and early 30s, decided that the library that worked best as a model for them was not New York, it was not Newport, it was not Charleston, and it was not Philadelphia, although they knew all four of those early libraries. In fact, it was Liverpool, but it wasn't the Liverpool library that I mentioned to you earlier. It was a new rival institution called the Liverpool Athenaeum, which had been founded in 1797. It's the first time the word Athenaeum had been used in connection with a library. I mean, there had been Athenaeums in the time of Hadrian in the 2nd century A.D., but that really had no relationship whatsoever to Athenaeums in either England or America. So what was it about the Liverpool Athenaeum that they really, really liked? It was the fact that it had a very bustling newsroom, what today we would call a newspaper room. Because what the Bostonians wanted, not just the merchants and the businessmen, but also those who were preaching each Sunday, what they wanted was information. They wanted news. They wanted news from newspapers, from the continent, from England, and throughout the colonies. And they also wanted magazines, as many as they could get their hands on. And so the Bostonians did something rather different. Instead of having a general subscription library, because there was already one of those in Boston, they put together something with an emphasis on news. But there was also something else that was quite unusual, because the Athenaeum in Boston did not circulate any of its books. For its first 20 years, it was a non-circulating, essentially a research library. And the scholarly work that we've been able to carry out during our bicentennial year, which is blessedly over next week, shows that, in fact, we had a much stronger scholarly library than Harvard College did in the 18-teens and 1820s, something we had no idea was the case. So what almost immediately happened was that aspiring American libraries started calling themselves Athenaeums. So the Redwood Library in Newport became the Redwood Library in Athenaeum. The next library to be founded was the Salem Athenaeum. Providence turned its two or three libraries into the Providence Athenaeum. Portsmouth created an Athenaeum, and so on and so forth, with the understanding that Athenaeum meant not just what it meant originally in Boston, but it was also tied to two other things. A fine arts collection, often including exhibition of fine arts, and lectures and discussion. And of course, the Great Lyceum movement in America took place in the 1820s and 30s and 40s. So it all came together, and to a certain extent, Boston was the granddaddy in that. But something else then happened as well. Because the future of libraries in the 19th century in America was not really in Athenaeums. It was in three other kinds of library. Two of them were invented in 1820. One was called a mechanics library or mechanics institute. You've got one here in New York. And that was, of course, part of a larger program to provide adult education for young men who were apprentices. And then there was the mercantile library movement, which was a kind of social scale upwards of maybe one gradation. And those libraries were created in order to provide reading matter for young aspiring clerks and young would-be merchants. So those spread like wildfire, and they spread not just on the eastern seaboard, but they all the way up to the Mississippi. Almost every American city had either a mechanics or a mercantile library. And then something else happened, and it happened again in Boston, which was the origin of the public library movement in roughly 1850. And for a long time it was thought that with the birth of the public library, all of these other libraries, all of them membership libraries of one kind or another, whether it was a library society, a society library, a library company, an Athenaeum, a mechanics library, or a mercantile library, it was thought that they essentially lost their way between 1850 and 1875 or so. But there's recent research that actually has taught us that they continued to grow at least until 1875. And it wasn't until the 1870s and 1880s that the public library movement finally took most of the life out of the membership library movement in this country. And what happened to all of those membership libraries? Well, 16 of us are still going, and there are quite a few that are smaller in New Haven and other places around the country that we don't necessarily know as much about as we would like to. But there are 16 fairly large surviving membership libraries. What happened to the others? Some of them folded. Some of them merged with other libraries, oftentimes with a local college or university. And I think most of them that survived actually merged or became the public library in their neighborhood or in their city. So that, you know, how many of these membership libraries were created by the year 1875? 3,300 in this country. And I went down to Australia to lecture 3.5 years ago, and I was astonished to learn that in Australia alone, in the 19th century, 2,500 membership libraries and institutes had been created, and that something like 1,200 of them still exist in Australia, in very small towns. Believe me, very small towns. They are the center of town. So, I just want to, before I go on and talk about the individual libraries themselves, I want to augment what I've said about mercantile and mechanics libraries, because in the essay on the Cincinnati Library, in the book we've published, there's a wonderful quotation. I'm just going to take a moment to read it to you, because it will give you a sense of how serious people were about self-improvement in the 19th century. So here it is. We are young men. We are banded together for self-improvement. Very limited, for the most part, have been our educational advantages. Yet we live in an enlightened age, in a land of liberty. The sun of knowledge in its meridian splendor is beaming down upon us. The world itself is waking up and shaking off the lethargy of ages. Shall we be sluggards? Nay. But let us grasp at every means of improvement within our reach. Let us read, think, act in the living present. Let us strive earnestly and heartily for that dignified and ennobling self-culture to which every end and aim and object of life should converge as toward a common center, without which man is of little worth and with which he can accomplish all things. Isn't that nice? Yeah. Now, I'm going to ask if we can turn on the laptop and turn the lights down. And I'll take you on a little bit of a magical history tour here. And I have to just give you one small apology. We realized when we started the program up earlier this evening that a handful of the slides have been corrupted. Corrupted in Cincinnati, I have to tell you, more or less. So we've lost a few of them, but we have most of them. Okay. Remember the days of slides? I was converted to PowerPoint about a year ago. But I've rarely given a presentation when there hasn't been a little something that proves to be difficult. Now we're going to go back. There we go. Okay. So I'm going to start you off at the Redwood Library and Athenaeum in Newport, 1747. This is one of the most beautiful buildings in America. Peter Harrison was the architect. I'm happy to say I'm also a proprietor of this wonderful library. This is a library that was thought to be so handsome when it opened in 1747 that during the Revolutionary War, Jefferson brought Washington to take a look at it. He wanted him to see what Northern architecture could look like, which I think is just great. This is the oldest surviving library building in the country. And it's just had a fabulous renovation and expansion. And this is the main reading room, which was added by George Snell in 1858. And just off to the left, which you can't see, there's a new sculpture gallery, which is very successful. And there's a good deal of important portraiture there. Many of you know that Gilbert Stuart grew up just outside of Newport, and this is a wonderful early self-portrait. I wish we had this in Boston. Now, Charleston has a library society founded in 1748. By the way, I'm not showing you Philadelphia, and that's because, well, I'm not showing you the library company in Philadelphia. That's because a couple of decades ago, they decided that they were no longer a membership library, that they were an independent research library. And so they have downplayed their history in that direction, I'm afraid to say, although, of course, it remains a very, very important institution, but it isn't actually part of our informal group. So Charleston ranks as the second oldest surviving and practicing subscription library in the country. This is the building on King Street, which actually was built in 1914. And there's another building that they just opened a few years ago next door called the Ripley Rathmel Building, which has a children's library in it. And that doubled the space available to them. This is the reading room, kind of bird's eye view of it. This is a library that, if I say it's in transition, that would be an understatement. They had no computers until very recently. They have had a small membership, virtually no fundraising, and only within the last 2 years have they really, really focused on rebuilding their institution. And I think the signs are very good because they've got a culture there that is very rich and that I think will absolutely support this wonderful building and institution. Well, one interesting thing about Charleston is that they have all of their 18th century purchase records. So a scholar at Oxford named James Raven has been able to publish a very large book in which he can analyze precisely which books were purchased by Charleston from which book dealers in London at which prices, and how long did it take for them to get over? And did they get over? And then what happened during the Revolutionary War? So it's a fascinating book. I've got to be honest with you. It's got fascinating material in it. It's not a very readable book, but it's got, as Boswell said, the things he couldn't publish in his Life of Johnson. It's got mighty good stuff in it, nonetheless. And, of course, New York comes next, 1754, and here we are on 79th Street. And I think what's typical of Philadelphia, Boston, and New York in particular is that if you look at the list of your founding members, they are really a who's who, who's important in both the financial and the cultural world of, in your case, mid-18th century New York. And also what's typical of this institution is that it moved around a good deal and had to contend with a number of other institutions that wanted to do things that were often very similar to it. Now, what I think everyone who's reading our book is fascinated by is your recent scanning and cataloging project based on your members' charge cards. And this is Auden's, of course, and it's everything from Novalis and Ortega y Gasset to the wit and wisdom of G.K. Chesterton. It's really, really wonderful to see what you have. And, of course, you've had so many authors who have been members here in New York, Juna Barnes, John Dos Passos, Edgar Lee Masters, Ogden Nash, Roald Dahl, Lillian Hellman, Wendy Wasserstein, and Susan Sontag. And I think that the friends I have who have read Mark and Sarah's chapter, I think their favorite bit is that anecdote of Truman Capote decades ago going out into a snowstorm with a heavily appareled woman whom he did not know and striking up a conversation with her and going to have a drink with her and telling her how much he loved this book he was reading called My Antonia, to which she said, actually, I wrote it. Now, some of the Athenaeum, Boston Athenaeum images have dropped out, I'm afraid to say, but this is the great reading room on the fifth floor of our building. The building, although we were founded in 1807, the building opened in 1849. It was our fourth home. And this particular floor was actually added during a grand renovation between 1913 and 1915. And then we did the same thing again between 1999 and 2002. We were out of our building for three entire years, and we executed a $30 million building and expansion program. Renovation expansion program. And I think that I think we're going to lose the next one. So let me just tell you what you're missing here. Of course, you can look at the book and see the images there. We have a number of important paintings, and I was going to show you one by Gilbert Stuart of our founding librarian, William Smith Shaw. He was called Athenaeum Shaw because when he had his suits made, he had big pockets made on the outside and extra large pockets made on the inside of his greatcoat, so that wherever he went, if you invited him to dinner, he would insist on taking your books and pamphlets home with him, saying, the Athenaeum must have this and it must have that. And he would put them in his own clothing. When he died, it was found that a lot of the Athenaeum things were in his apartment and a lot of his things were at the Athenaeum, but we finally got it sorted out. Just a few highlights. We have most of George Washington's library, and we have the largest collection of Confederate imprints in the country. We have a great deal of artwork that comes from Jefferson's Monticello. We have something like 600,000 volumes, and currently about 7,800 people who have membership cards. Well, let me move on to Salem. This is a beautiful building. It's just about 100 years old. But it's a small membership, and it's only open, so many hours a week. The director is part-time. So it gives you some sense of scale here. If Boston is the largest, and if New York and Philadelphia are the next largest, then we go down to something as small as Salem. But in fact, and I'm on to Philadelphia now, Salem is really a wonderful hub for people who are interested in literature, history, biography, and so on, in that wonderful town just north of Boston. Now, the second great library in Philadelphia is the Athenaeum, and it was founded in 1814. This is the members' reading room in the building that was designed by John Notman, a very important architect, in 1847 on Washington Square. And I'm going to show you another reading room. What's interesting about the Athenaeum of Philadelphia is that very early on in the 20th century, it focused on American architecture. architecture. Obviously, building a library on architecture, but also building a very important collection of blueprints and drawings. The American Institute of Architects actually occupied part of the building in the 19th century. And under the most recent director, Roger Moss, this collection has been expanded dramatically. And there is now a digital project called the American Architects and Buildings Project, which is extraordinary. It began by focusing on Philadelphia, and now it's a national project. But if, for instance, you bought a brownstone someplace in Philadelphia, and you wanted to know something about who built it, how it had changed over the years, who owned it, were there photographs of it, were there architectural plans for it, all of that is in the database, and it's free of charge. You can look at it. There are no proprietary rights unless you want material, you know, as an architect or as a developer or contractor. So it's an extraordinary enterprise. I move on to one of my favorite buildings. This is in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and this is their Athenaeum, which was founded in 1817, but the building is actually earlier. It dates back to 1805. It's on Market Square. It's right in the heart of a city that is very, very active these days. It's got a number of people who have retired there. It is still proprietors only, and until a few years ago, every proprietor had a key and could come and go whenever he or she wished to. That's a very bad idea. And this is the Sawtelle Reading Room with the antlers. I love it. It's just it's really a kind of snapshot of New England life. Now, here we are in New York again. This is the library of the General Society of Mechanics and Tradesmen. So this is a mechanics library. Founded in 1820, the very first year these were founded. It's now usually called the General Society. And it has this beautiful atrium reading room designed by Ralph Townsend. Within, I love this, what was the indoor parade ground of the Berkeley School for Boys on West 44th Street. And then I'll show you, here's the library committee meeting in 1878 in a previous building. A number of important 19th century merchants were members of this library, William Colgate and Peter Cooper in particular. And although it has a large rare book and circulating collection today, it also has extensive resources for studying labor history in New York and, in fact, in this country. Now, just a few blocks away is the Mercantile Library Center for Fiction, also 1820. The title is an amalgamation of other institutions, and it took on its new title for fiction, that is, Mercantile Library Center for Fiction, just 3 years ago in 2005. So it's a very active membership library devoted to fiction in particular, but also the literary arts generally, with prizes and lectures focusing on editing and publishing and bookselling as well as writing. Here we are in Cincinnati. This is the Mercantile Library, 1835. They stenciled the names of all of the important lecturers who came out to Cincinnati in the 19th century. It is unusual because it's fairly high up in a high-rise building in downtown Cincinnati. It has stayed there for a long, long time. It has, listen to this, a 10,000-year lease with all utilities paid. As my counterpart there, Albert Pyle, likes to say, it is a very good lease. We have no intention of moving. And here's the Hiram Powers bust of Washington. So Walnut Street is really a center in a very rapidly changing Cincinnati. But what is so typical of an urban center like Cincinnati is that so many empty nesters are moving back downtown, and in fact they are rebuilding their membership in a very healthy way. But this is the Providence Athenaeum, 1836, but as I said, there were important 18th century libraries in Providence. You see Washington there on the right again, and Franklin on the left. So its roots actually go back to something called the Providence Library Company of 1753, which was certainly based on Franklin's experiment in Philadelphia. And this is 19th century photograph, but this is what it looks like today. And it's, I think it's fair to say that recently it's been a real laboratory for membership library issues. Because they decided not to be a proprietary library, that is, they gave up their shares. They discovered that their building had significant structural problems. And they realized that they didn't know for years what they had actually been spending. So they were invading capital in a horrific way. And they therefore made the very difficult decision of selling their Audubon Birds of America. Which fetched $5 million here in New York. Not as much, I think, as they wished to capture from that important move. And, in fact, before they could sell Audubon's birds, they had to face a lawsuit by some of the people who used to be proprietors and who no longer had their shares, who took them to court, but they were unsuccessful. Anyway, I think they're doing much better today. Now, talk about merging. This is a very interesting story in St. Louis. The St. Louis Mercantile Library was founded in 1846. And what happened was that it actually merged with the University of Missouri at St. Louis just about 10 years ago. And so this is a new building. And this is an atrium. I think this is very handsome. This is actually one of the two libraries around the country I have not had a chance to get to yet. But it I think, has worked very well for them because they have a beautiful new safe environment. They've got lots of storage space. They've got students who can work there at a very inexpensive rate. And they've got faculty members and researchers who are putting it to use all the time. And this is a print of what it looked like in St. Louis. In the 19th century, this particular library was the first cultural institution founded in St. Louis, and therefore, I think, west of the Mississippi. This is the wonderful spiral staircase that will take you from one floor to another in San Francisco in the Mechanics Institute, which was founded in 1854. And this is a library that has moved many, many times. It is a very peripatetic essay that you will be reading if you read about San Francisco in our book. And, of course, it had to face not only the normal fires, but the Great Fire and the earthquake. This is 57 Post Street, really in the heart of the city. Now, oftentimes we find out at our annual directors' meetings that San Francisco has the largest number of members, a few more than Boston. Why is that? Because they have the largest, the oldest, and the most prestigious chess club in this country, or so they tell me. Perhaps New York has one that you would wish to tout. But in fact, in order to become a member of the chess club, you have to become a member of the library. Great idea. Now, here's where I've lost a couple of slides, I'm afraid. So what I'm not showing you is actually a very late development in New England. It's the St. Johnsbury Athenaeum, which was founded in 1871 and was a real cultural anchor for what we sometimes call the Northwest Kingdom. And is always thought of as being both a library and a major art gallery. And in fact, it has one of the most famous paintings in America within it. It's Albert Bierstadt's The Domes of Yosemite, finished in 1867. It is so large that they cannot lend it because they can't get it out of the room or out of the building. It is extraordinarily large and a very important part of what we still loosely call the Hudson River School of Painters. I can show you two final libraries, both small, both in communities that have been very, very popular with retired American. This is the Lanier Library Association, 1889 in Tryon, North Carolina. This is the cutest little town in the foothills of the mountains. And it was originally, 100 years ago, the kind of place you came to for a cure at a sanatorium if you were suffering from tuberculosis. And that's what was ailing the poet Sidney Lanier. So he came, he promptly died, and they memorialized him with this library association. And it's really a remarkable community center today. Here's a peek inside at one of its reading rooms. We had a wonderful meeting down there a few years ago. And then finally, I'll show you the exterior of the baby in our group. Well, what a baby. La Jolla is a nice place indeed. So this is the Athenaeum Music and Arts Library in that part of San Diego called La Jolla. It was founded in 1899. You're looking at the main building, which was designed by William Templeton Johnson in 1921. And La Jolla has many interesting things to say for itself. This is a very, very handsome architecture. There is an arts school next door that is part of this institution. It was founded and has been almost entirely run by women throughout its history, and certainly at the moment it is an extraordinarily successful woman who was born in Germany, who has taken an arts institution and made it also into a major focus for music in Southern California. It also has a modest library, but that, of course, is growing a good deal as well. And what I was most impressed by, because we had our annual meeting there this past fall, is that it has a very serious exhibition gallery as well, and they've started a major collection of artist books. Well, I'd like to conclude my remarks this evening by saying that when we celebrated our bicentennial this past year, we tried to do two things at the same time. We obviously looked backwards. We published a very large exhibition catalog. It was our most ambitious art and book exhibition in about 130 years, and the largest publication we've ever published. And we brought it down to the Grolier Club for several months this last fall. And so we really tried to pay tribute to our predecessors who built both the book and the art collections over our 200-year history. But at the same time, we were trying to look forward. And we did that by doing something I don't necessarily recommend anyone else do, which was in the middle of our bicentennial celebration, also go through strategic planning. Both the entire staff of 54 people and our trustees and trustees emeriti. So that, too, was obviously a very, very healthy exercise. And in September, we had a trustee retreat, and they signed off on our next five-year strategic plan. So we're very much looking forward as best we can. And during that celebration, a young woman from the Boston Globe came by from their editorial department, and she spent some time with us, and she went away, and she published the following editorial. It came out in a Sunday paper. And I want to read you just two paragraphs from it, because I think it captures not just what we're trying to do in Boston, but what I think all of our membership libraries are trying to do across this country. So here's what she wrote about us. Here's what one needs to know about the Boston Athenaeum, the stately 200-year-old private library on Beacon Hill with a bulging collection of books, art, and artifacts. During a recent tour of its bicentennial exhibition, a little girl stopped past in blue jeans and flashing white sneakers as if she owned the place. And in a way, she does, because the Athenaeum is eager to belong to children and adults in a meaningful but easygoing way. A venerable institution, the Athenaeum is also hip, suffused with the knowledge that buildings are nothing without people and their stuff, their books and art, their history and research projects, their animated conversations, It's the life of the mind made solid and put on display. And I swear I didn't write that myself. Thank you very much.
I'd be happy.
Yeah.
One of the things that we're very proud of in the Republic of Library is a very much in a democratic quality tradition is that we are also a public library. Because anyone who comes in and you are a record person and police are brought there. So for the 16 the 16 is a book, are a number of them also public libraries, or are we unique?
I'm not sure you're unique, but you're unusual. And I think it's great what you do. At the Athenaeum in Boston, we are open to the public at all times. That is, they can come in, look at the architecture, look at the exhibition, and we do not charge for our exhibitions. We have three major exhibitions a year. And we have tours. Three tours of the building at least twice a week. And during the bicentennial and after we reopened, we were having open houses for the public as well, hoping that many of them would become members. But we don't allow non-members to use the collections themselves. We've talked about it, but in fact, the way we're set up, there's almost no place on the first floor one could do that. And once you get up further into the building, it poses all kinds of difficulties, we learned years ago. And I'm not, Mark, you may know something I don't, but I can't think of any other that is a public library, except possibly La Jolla, which has always had this kind of off and on relationship with the public library and may still allow its books to be used. But that's certainly not true in the others I'm thinking of right now. Charleston? Yeah. Nantucket is an interesting example. They were part of our group until perhaps 7 or 8 years ago. And then they found it politically ill-advised to talk about themselves as a membership library because more than 50% of their funding came from public sources in Nantucket. But in fact, they are, in many ways, very much like the rest of us, and I'm hoping that they may join us. It's an informal group, and we call ourselves very different things, and we're nice to each other. So, yeah.
And maybe the wall is that this library and the London library are largely used by machine library users and new libraries thought of as a research library especially. Is that fair or am I just not familiar with that?
I don't think so. We have a large circulating collection. And those books are used a good deal, even if they're not checked out, we've discovered. That is, a lot of use is actually within the building these days. We have many, many more people using the building as a place to read and to write than before we reopened 5.5 years ago. So, yes, we are an independent research library, and we are a de facto rare book and manuscript library, but we're still very much a circulating library as well. In fact, I think of the London Library, which is in many ways a close sister institution to ours, as being almost more of a research institution than a general reading library. If you look at their book stock as you go into the London Library in St. James's Square, it's astonishing. The number of Oxford and Cambridge University Press books is perhaps 5 times the number we would buy in any given year. And you know why they were founded? by Thomas Carlyle, because the British Museum library would not allow him to take the books out of the building. Well, that was it. And so, yes, it is circulating, but I think for the most part, it's a very serious circulating institution. Any other questions?
Yeah. I could just suggest that you may or may not know this, but I was told by Paul McClurk the other day that there's been a very lively exchange of correspondence in the CLS on the Great with the London Library starting in November.
It's very amusing. Well, the London Library has probably underfunded itself in a number of ways for some time. And they decided to do what actually we did about a year and a half after we reopened. And we essentially doubled our fees. And they're significant in London, much more so than here in the States. And there's absolute outrage among even some of their reasonable members. But in fact, I think the resources of the London Library are extraordinary, and people should really find that as a way of supporting it. They have purchased a good deal of an adjacent building and have a great deal more space available to them than they had before. They're going to have to pay for that in a variety of ways, and having fees that reflect the cost of being a member, I think, is essential. I mean, we went from, well, put this in perspective for the Boston Athenaeum. I arrived 11 years ago exactly. I didn't want to raise fees my first year. And then we realized we were going to have to move out of the building, and that didn't seem fair. And we were out of the building for 3 years, and we didn't want to raise the fees while we were out of the building. And then the trustees told me not to raise fees my first year back in the building because that would be unfair. And so, you know, you could see things going like this. So I had to double them. And we lost members.
What could you just give us the numbers?
I can't give you precise numbers, but when we lost members, we lost them partly because of the increase in fees, but partly because many people joined us when we reopened to take a look-see. And many of them probably thought they weren't putting us to use, and so it didn't make sense to stay with us. Yes, right. We went from... So, in certain categories, there had not been an increase in the fee to be a member of the Athenaeum in 13 years. And at the very least, it was 9 years. So, in the highest category for proprietors, we went from $125 to $250. Today, we're at $290. So we saw a real drop in the number of members, and we almost doubled our revenue. So it was the right thing to do. And now what we've been doing is raising it 10% every 2 years, about 5% cost of living increase each year, but we don't do it each year. And we also underwrite, I mean, we subvene anyone's subscription who has a hardship. We have about 150 volunteers, and many of them are retired members of the community who essentially earn their membership by volunteering for us. Children are free, and any students are free, and all visiting scholars are free. So, yeah. As I said before, we're both de facto special collections libraries, because what one was purchasing for general consumption in 1780 or 1850 or even 1900 is now essentially a rare book. Our strengths are in European, British, and American history, literature, and art. We have general books on science, religion, and medicine. And you'll find some interesting pockets. Our readers do like mysteries. Most membership libraries have readers who like mysteries. And cookbooks, the culinary arts are very important to us. But it's a general collection based in those areas. And within America, as you can imagine, we're strongest in New England and Boston history and literature, but we collect a little bit of everything. Now, sometimes I'm asked, how do you decide what to choose? Because you have to make hard decisions. You can't buy, not only can you not buy everything, but you can't buy many of the things you'd like to have in the library. And we have three ways of doing it. We have standing orders with the major university presses for the series that we think are important. So it might be the complete works of Edmund Burke from the 18th century, or it might be a series from the 19th century that Oxford is bringing up. The second way is to have a group of staff members who now have the title of bibliographer for fiction or bibliographer for art history or whatever it is, and they meet every 2 weeks, and they make sure that we're buying what they think we should be buying. The third way, and this is something I was dismayed by when I first came to the Athenaeum, but now that we have these other forms of policy, collection development, I'm much more comfortable with it, is that every 2 weeks, our members, including some of our trustees and a few staff members, get together in the trustees' room. They bring in their clippings. They read their clippings to each other. This is a social event, and this is why I like it. They're actually educating each other, sharing enthusiasms, asking for advice. On the top of this wonderful table that the trustees use, there is a wonderful Asian bowl. If the clipping is approved, it goes in the bowl. At the end of the hour and a half or 2 hours, everything that's in the bowl gets ordered. But of course, what many of these people do, I mean, they're so pleased that their choice has been accepted that they buy the book anyway for the library, which is a nice thing, too. We have a number of people who will give us a subscription either to a newspaper or to a periodical. I think we're now subscribing to 650 periodicals. Now, that seems like a lot, but it's a small fraction of what any research library at a university would do. I should say, we have really good historic collections in French and in a few other European languages. And we've tested the membership to see if that would continue to be of interest. But it's not. We have a French library in the Back Bay, and we have the Goethe Institute, and they take care of those interests. And so we're English only at this point. Helen. Yeah. So programming is really at the heart of our institution. There's sometimes when I think that we have members only because they want to come to the program. If there are 365 days in the year, not this year, I think it's fair to say that last year we had 174 events. And that's not unusual. That includes discussion groups. We have tea every 2 weeks on Wednesday afternoons. We have children's events of all kinds, ranging from book readings to puppet shows, marionettes, and magic shows, and the Globe Hornbook Awards. But the heart of the programming is a series of lectures. And part of the strategic planning process was to decide if we could do an even better job of that. And we've decided we can in one way. We have 1 to 3 lectures a week, except during the summer. They're held on the ground floor, and we usually sell out at about 180 to 200 people, which is terrific. We charge for about half of them. We don't charge for any talk that I would give or anything having to do with an exhibition, anything having to do with an Athenaeum publication. Anything. Well, we now have 4 endowed lectureships. We don't charge for those lectures. But we do try to charge for about half of them. We charge $10 usually. And we the Royal Oak lectures, which are I think here held at the Grolier Club, are always held at the Athenaeum in Boston. So what we decided was that we could do a better job of categorizing and marketing these events for our members and for prospective members. So we think that we have 3 very good series right now. We have family and children's programming. We have biography, literature, and history. And we have art and architecture and the decorative arts. And instead of sending out individual invitations, which we've done from time to time, and instead of sending out a group of 5 or 6 within a brochure, what we're going to start doing in the fall is a fall mailing and then a winter-spring mailing. Everything that is on the books as of June for the fall will be in this one book. And it will be by category, so there'll be a kind of marketing or branding approach to it. So that if you're interested in literature, you can just follow down. If you're interested in art and architecture, you can follow straight through. But then everything will be chronologically listed as well. And we think that that's going to be effective. But we've also decided that we should do a better job with what I would call a kind of scattershot approach to what we're calling civic discourse. I mean, we've always been an institution that's had lectures on issues of importance current interest. Well, we had Fred Krupp come up from New York about 6 or 7 weeks ago in environmental defense. Gary Wills gave a talk about his new book on religion in America. We do quite a few of these each year, but we've never done them in a very good thematically coherent way. And so that is our new venture. To have civic discourse be something that is closely identified with the Athenaeum and done in a way that doesn't look as if it's the Kennedy School at Harvard or the JFK Library or the Ford Hall Forum or any of the other places around town that do have events of this kind. So we're taking this year as the opportunity to decide how best to do it. And the first thing I've done is to form a partnership with the most local of our universities. It's called Suffolk University. It's a 100-year-old, very, very aggressive and very successful university that literally surrounds us on Beacon Hill. And they've got a larger auditorium than we have, one that will seat 400 people, and it will allow us to reach out to the general public for the first time. Not only that, but they've got faculty members and students who will be part of what we put together. They have eminent visiting guests each year, and once we choose a topic, they're going to choose some of those guests. So that, if for instance, let's say it's globalization for 2008-2009, I'm not sure it will be, but it's a possibility, they might invite some specialists in the perils and prospects of globalization to be part of their program and therefore people they could share with us. So I think that's all very exciting. And I spent a bit of the early afternoon talking to one of our proprietors here in New York who's very excited about that too and may help us to get it launched. So I think it's a good step for us. One yes, Janelle. Oh, yes. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for your wonderful support of our program. Conservation is as important as anything else. If the books and the artwork are not properly taken care of, as you know, you really are not going to be able to provide access to them. And so when we had our renovation project, we took some of the building next door, the basement and sub-basement area, and we were able to build a state-of-the-art conservation laboratory. We have the oldest lab at any library in New England. But to be honest, that wasn't saying much. It was a kind of amateurish affair in some ways. And now it's absolutely state-of-the-art. We've expanded the hours and number of people. We have an internship program that's going 12 months a year. I hired away from Harvard Graduate School of Design a new chief conservator who is fabulous. And he's gotten everybody excited. And we've gotten something like 7 or 8 gifts of equipment. The latest came in from a local trust just 2 or 3 weeks ago, so that we have sophisticated tools that we never had before. And I'm very, very proud of what we've been able to do. And every fall we have a conservation evening, and we put on display about 20 paintings, statues, maps, drawings, prints, manuscripts, and books that are in need of adoption. And they're all adopted that evening. It's a wonderful evening. And then we work with the donors throughout the year. We bring them in, show them what we're doing, and we show them the final product. And when we have conservation night the next fall, there they are. They're all conserved. And we've got 20 more objects in dire need of support. And, you know, the dollar amount is not huge, but we don't want to expand it because there's such a good feeling every time we do this in the evening. People feel they're part of a special community, so it's been good for us. And then a lot of people will say, I can't make it, find something that's not in the program, and we'll adopt it for you. So that's been very nice.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.